Anyway, former Mayor Robert J. LaFortune, I'd like to welcome you to the Tulsa Historical Society. And today is Thursday, January the 20th, 2005. My name is Chuck Ayers. And I would like to ask you, let me make that's kind of a statement, a preface to a question. Tulsa, I think accurately could be said that during your term as mayor, I think it's between 1970 and 1978.
That's correct.
That it was pretty much truly the oil capital of the world at that time. And things were happening, such as the Port Authority had come into existence and the Performing Arts Center, and that was opened and developed. And American Airlines was moving a lot of their operations to Tulsa. And I think someone ascribed or attributed that the Tulsa was the most beautiful city in America, one of the most beautiful cities in America. And lots was going on. The Port of Catoosa was opened. And what I'd like to find out, my question is, how did Tulsa, what was it in Tulsa that created this environment, and how did you, as the mayor at that time, what role did you play in the development of Tulsa?
Well, I think Tulsa had a good run of growth following World War II, and we had a lot of growth in the energy companies that located here. And we were very fortunate that we had a lot of headquarters-centered oil and gas companies here, and drilling companies. So we had what you would have to say today is a robust economic climate. I think through the 60s and into the 70s. Things began to change when the Arab oil embargo was put on, and when the move of the large headquarters-centered companies in Tulsa became parts of larger organizations, and they moved their top corporate management away. That was certainly a change that occurred during the 70s and early 80s, and it has virtually continued because of the decline of the production capabilities of our state, about as much as anything. When Tulsa was the oil capital of the world, they had all of these old established oil and gas companies with the owners and the managers, the original founders, living right here. Parts of our leadership in our community, and when they moved their headquarters out, or they became acquired, as would have happened to City Service, for instance, you began to see a change not only in the types of businesses that provided our job base, but you also begin to see a decline in the numbers of employees based here. Mm-hmm. So as a result, we've lost 20 to 30,000 jobs, mostly from the energy sector and mostly from downtown Tulsa.
Can you speak about the development of the Port of Catoosa? My understanding, you had some interest in that.
Yes, I was involved either as a street the commissioner of streets and public property in the from 64 to 70. I was a part of the 1965 bond issue that provided $20 million from the city of Tulsa to build the port. Mm-hmm. And as this street commissioner, I was put in charge of the acquisition of the land, some 2,300 or 2,400 acres at the current site of the port. So that was acquired in my office, and for a very nominal price, I might add, by today's standards of property values. Less than $1 million was spent on the acquisition of the entire 2,300 acres. I also had the opportunity, because of being in charge of public properties, to somewhat represent the city in some of the design aspects of the port itself. So as the engineering company was laying out the kinds of improvements they needed to provide for the port, that is the wharfage, the warehouses, the utilities, the street infrastructure, all of those things, why I was usually involved in those conferences, at least, and the departments of the city had a lot of input as to the specifications of the buildings and the utilities and the streets that were installed.
What difficulty did you have convincing the city or the county governments that this is a project worthwhile? And what was your prognosis for it? I mean, what did you predict the port would do?
Well, the real selling of the port came during the Hughley administration and the Maxwell administration preceding him. It was actually in the last term that Jim Maxwell had, in the early term, the two terms that Jim Hughley had. And it really was sold on the economic development benefits that would occur because of the port. And we had some financial support from Rogers County, probably $1 million or so. But the major funds that were invested in it really came from the city of Tulsa.
Let's talk about the, did you have a part in developing and putting together the Performing Arts Center, and what would have been?
Well, yes, the PAC is a very, to me, a very interesting story and kind of a unique use of the public and private partnership that Tulsa has long been very well known for in its throughout this history of the city. We had been, ever since the late 60s, we had been interested in providing a new theater for Tulsa. And we had different committees. We had one chaired by Charles Norman at one time that looked at the different possibilities of using already existing facilities, such as the old Shriner, it's not Shriner, it's the one that was at 4th and Denver. It was a small theater in itself, mm-hmm. as a part of a building owned by what would you call it, a fraternal organization. Mm-hmm. And we looked at that as a possible site of a theater. In Tulsa's history, they had wanted to put a theater in. We added money in the 1969 bond issue in Tulsa for a new theater, but it failed badly. It lacked less than 25% of the vote, as I recall.
How'd you compensate?
And well, our response to that was to just kind of continue the study, and and then we had a very lucky event, and that occurred when John Williams, because of his brother and others who had approached him, he knew that the city was interested in a theater. And it occurred to him, because they were developing the Williams Center complex at that time, it occurred to him that a theater as a part of that complex would be a nice addition, not only to what they were doing, but to the city itself. And so John secured a very generous donation from Lita Chapman, from the well-known Chapman family in Tulsa, and another a very generous family to many things, including several universities, the University of Tulsa, John Brown University, Trinity University, and probably other charitable beneficiaries. But at any rate, John approached Mrs. Chapman to get a lead gift. And so he came to the city with that, and he asked me, he said, if, because the cost of a new theater then was estimated to be around $14 million, he said if he could provide half of that in private donations, would the city call a bond issue for the other half? And of course, I readily agreed that that would be a wonderful way to approach it and to encourage people, you know, to use the leverage of the private donation to vote for the bond issue. So with that, we went ahead and called the $7 million bond issue, put it on by itself in the summer, which is usually a poor time to have a bond election. And it passed with a very high percentage, probably close to 70%. And then we set about on the construction. The story doesn't particularly end with just the funding that was provided there, though, because we ran into almost immediately a construction cost number that was higher than the money we had. So when the price of the theater came in at about $18 million instead of $14 million that we had, there had to be more fundraising. So John went back and raised another $2 million from the private sector, and the city put up another $2 million, mostly from revenue sharing monies that we were receiving at the time from the federal government for community projects. So that got our funding at least straightened out and permitted the construction to be done.
Do you remember when the Performing Arts Center was, the inaugural or the premier performance?
Pretty much, yes.
It was there.
Ella Fitzgerald was the key performer for that event. That's right.
Yeah.
And that also that also marked the start of our Performing Arts Center Trust, which was actually funded. The endowment for the PAC Trust started because we finished the building project with about $1 million of extra money. Mm-hmm. And that became an endowment which has been cared for and somewhat expanded since then for use in providing programming for the theater itself. I still serve as a member of that trust, as does John Williams and Charles Norman, and until her death, Katie Westby, who was very important in organizing interest for the theater through all these years that I've just described. So we still have kind of, you might say, a residue benefit from the construction occurring with our PAC Trust operations. We meet every other month, and we are a major incentivizer, you might say, for programming at the theater.
Mm-hmm. Let me back up this a little bit and go back to when you were street commissioner and mayor early in your mayoral career. Why did you decide to run for public for political office, or especially in the city government? You know, the city governments don't pay well, and
Well,
What led you into that?
it certainly hadn't been the pay, has it?
No. I do remember one news release that you were trying to raise the mayor's pay up to $30,000, something like that. And,
oh, yeah.
Which was, I thought was kind of interesting.
That was a far cry from what it was when I started, I think. Mm-hmm. When I first became a commissioner in 1964, I think we were paid $12,000 or $13,000 a year, and the mayor probably got $18,000 a year. I don't know. I don't even know those numbers. But and the jobs were considered full-time jobs. They were not considered part-time jobs. But my interest in running for office was engendered through a couple of friends of mine who were very active in Republican politics here. And they approached me late 63 to run for mayor. And I hadn't been involved in city affairs in any way. I was involved in some community work, but not in the city political spectrum at all. And I said, no, I don't know enough about that job to go out publicly and talk about what the issues are and all of that. So they left, and in a few days they came back and said, well, if you don't want to do that, why don't you run for this commissioner of streets and public property, because you are a graduate engineer, and that's a job that would that you would seem to be educationally qualified for, if in no other way, which is probably about right. And I said, okay, I'll try that. At least a casual friend, but a person whom I admired very much, named Dean Langenheim, who was the retired head of the Petroleum Engineering School at the University of Tulsa, was then serving as the Water and Sewer Commissioner. And so I went to visit him, and of course, he was the only Republican on the commission. All of the commission, from Maxwell to the other commissioners, was all Democrat. And that was a big focus in those days, what party you were in. So in order to try and give him a little support as the only Republican, I said, okay, I'll run for the office. Maybe y'all can tell me a little more about what I'm supposed to be doing. And so that's what happened. I ran. And had a very, very low budget. I think I spent about $5,000 for my whole campaign, and won. And neither paper endorsed me. They endorsed the incumbent, Guy Hall, who had done a fine job. Nothing wrong with the work that Guy Hall had done, but at least I won. And then I stayed in that office for three terms, and I think the second term I was elected without an opponent, and then the third term I think I had an opponent. Mm-hmm. So then Hughley came along and beat Maxwell in 66 when I was running for the second time. And so Jim was a very good friend of mine. I wouldn't have thought of running against him. But when he dropped out in 1970, I decided I should try mayor. By then, I felt like I knew enough about city affairs and the job of the mayor to do a good job.
Why don't we back way up?
Don't go too far.
You grew up in Tulsa. Is that right?
Yes, I was born here in 1927.
1927. So. You went to Marquette, and then you went to
Cacher Marquette, Hall. And I went to Cacher in the seventh grade. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then when I graduated from high school, I went to TU for about a year, less than a year.
Mm-hmm. Well, my question is, during that time, through your formative years up through high school, what was Tulsa like? What was, I don't want to appear to be Well, what was going on in Tulsa, maybe downtown or the city itself, that it was
You're talking about the
maybe
40s, maybe?
in the 40s, yeah. And what was exciting? What was going on? What was the downtown like? Or did you hang around?
I don't know that I can give you a whole lot of memories from that. I was a high schooler, I was a college student, and then I was gone. I went in the service for almost 2 years.
Any particular event that you thought was memorable?
Well, the city then was so heavy in the oil and gas industry, and somewhat in the aviation industry, because I think even the airport industries were beginning to settle in here. American Airlines was establishing their base here. But the oil and gas and energy side of the economy was what was driving Tulsa in those days. And either that or the industries that supported oil and gas or supported oil field operations. Servicing companies, well logging companies, the geologists. We had a wealth of geologists all promoting deals and thinking up ways of places to drill and promoting money and but in addition to the independent side of the oil and gas business, we still had the growth of these companies. Just like when City Service decided to move here. I can't remember the year they moved here. It's probably around 1970 or maybe a little before then. That was a major coup for Tulsa to get the movement of that whole company and their corporate headquarters and everything to Tulsa. They built their new building that they have down there on Boulder at 7th Street.
You remember when the streetcars were running through Tulsa?
Vaguely, just as a kid growing up, but not in the established areas of the city. I think the only ones I remember were the ones that may have come in from the suburbs, maybe like Sand Springs or something.
Did you visit downtown, like to restaurants or movie
Oh
theaters?
yeah, as a high schooler, all the time. Yes, we used all the theaters. That's where you went on your dates. The Ritz, the Orpheum, the Rialto, the Majestic, even the suburban theaters like the Delman at 15th and Lewis, and the Plaza Theater at 15th and Peoria. And
Do you recall 1949 when Tulsa had a premiere of the movie Tulsa?
yes, vaguely. I'm not sure I
Or were
even
you
went
out
to.
of town at that time? So.
I don't believe I went to the premiere, but I do certainly remember it coming here. I've seen the movie several times.
Supposedly a big event when they had a big parade.
There.
Anyway, any other remembrances or recollections you'd like to share with us that maybe your legacy as mayor or
Well, there was another area that we haven't talked about that
Okay.
I spent a lot of time on, and that was our expressway system.
Okay.
And the development of the interstate highway system, which started in 1958, at the end of Eisenhower's term, last term, was a great impetus for highway construction throughout the country. And so Tulsa was, I think, very, very eager to get involved in that, and they did approve several, at least one or more city and county bond issues that funded the right-of-way acquisition and utility costs for the start of our expressway systems. So when I first ran for the street commissioner, several of the expressways we kind of take for granted for today were just being built. The Broken Arrow happened to be one of them. And of course, it was a key road in the development of Tulsa to the southeast, as we all know. But the Crosstown Expressway was pretty much the design for it, and the funds that were used from the city side to buy right away for it were all parts of things that I was a part of as a street commissioner. And I've been very proud of our expressway system. It's a first-rate system. It's proved to be a very successful, very capable of carrying the traffic with the normal expansions that you've had to incur because of growth in just neighborhoods and number of cars that were serving the population growth. But it's a very efficient system.
Mm-hmm. Were you involved in any of the further development of the Airport Authority?
I served on the Airport Authority and, of course, appointed members to it while I was mayor. And I attended all of their meetings as a member of the Airport Authority. Mm-hmm. And it had very good years. Those were all good growth years in the airport when I was mayor and before and after that. One of the things I always like to give credit to is what other people do. Mm-hmm. And Tulsa, I think, was blessed with some really visionary governmental thinking in the 50s and 60s. And I say that because we established some city-county agencies that today function without hardly any ripples at all. We have one of the finest health departments, city-county health departments in the state of Oklahoma, probably the finest one in the state or this region. We have a wonderful city-county library system. Mm-hmm. We had a city-county planning authority, which to me, for when you consider how cities tend to break off in very parochial ways, having your planning on a county-wide basis was a very important thing in having good growth in all of Tulsa County. And it doesn't mean that you can get into other counties very easily because they're very parochial too about how they plan. Mm-hmm. But to have our planning done on a countywide basis was very significant in orderly growth of our city and county. And those those city-county authorities have been very important in knitting together the small towns with Tulsa. We kind of overlook that. You begin to see, like today, when there's talk about fracturing those relationships over water sales, mm-hmm. you realize that perhaps we have some of our political leaders who are losing sight of how important these relationships have been through the years of knitting together our suburban cities with the central city.
Just something that would be of kind of follow-up to that, and maybe something that's only concerned about currently. Do you think the commission form of government worked better than the council form of government? Or?
I think it definitely had some advantages in
the commission.
In the efficiency of the operation. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't have necessarily, but I think it may have.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this is where they're having their difficulties at this point because they're...
Well, I think we didn't have any choice about changing the form. Yeah, The change of form came about because of the litigation that had happened over the country with other commission forms, mm-hmm. Because they did not provide assurance that a person from a minority section of the city could be elected. Mm-hmm. So...
Anything else you could think of that would be of interest to the Historical Society that they could pass on as part of your legacy or part of
Well, there are a couple of other things that I was involved in that are probably not too much interest to the Historical Society. One was I was instrumental in starting what's called now the Indian Nations Council of Governments, which is the planning body now for Tulsa County. Mm-hmm. But at the time, it was the first attempt for Tulsa to set up some coordinative planning functions with our surrounding counties. That is, so that you could get your highway system in particular and any utility type of planning coordinated with your next-door neighbors. So you weren't doing things here in isolation of what they were doing, nor were they doing something in isolation from what you knew about. One other thing that I did as a street commissioner was to make the transition from a private bus company to a public, to our MTTA. Okay. And that fell to my office when I was still a commissioner to get the MTTA established and purchase the bus system from MKNO Lines, which operated it as a private entity, and acquire the ownership and get your union contract with their bus drivers and take over their, through a purchase. We did an appraisal of their properties and the equipment, and we offered and negotiated a purchase of their facilities.
When you were mayor, your vision of what Tulsa could be, has that pretty much been fulfilled, or do you think there's still work to be done?
Well, it's probably never fulfilled because I did emphasize park development in Tulsa. I think partially because of my dad's interest in the park that he developed at LaFortune Park.
Can you tell me how that came about? Would you have time to elaborate on that, LaFortune Park?
I think it was a very interesting way that it came about. You have to go back far enough to kind of think about how the welfare system operated in during the war years and shortly thereafter, even up into the 50s. There really wasn't a welfare system. The county had a what they called you would call in today's vernacular a county poor farm. They had a half a section of land where LaFortune Park sits today, and they had some housing out there. So when there were indigent families that were absolutely down and out and had no place to go, they would try and find room in some of this housing out there. I remember the buildings, but I don't remember how they accommodated people. They grew. They had a vegetable farm, in effect. They grew food out there. I guess they sold some and they used some, but that was the way they took care of indigent families. As the federal welfare system came into being, why the need for that county facility out there went away. Mm-hmm. So the county commission was considering selling it. And of course, at that time, it was a pretty hot development area of the city, around 51st Street, even going south of 51st and around that whole area around Yale, Harvard, Sheridan. There was interest in housing development. Some chamber people, and I particularly remember Harvey Heller's name being associated with this, approached my dad. And I guess they approached the county commissioners too with the idea that if someone would develop that property as a park, that they wouldn't need to sell it, that they could use it as a park. So that's what they did. They approached my dad, and he was right from the start very, very interested and enthusiastic about it. And he put about $1 million into the development of LaFortune Park. And they started with the golf course, of course, and the swimming pool, and that was the first, and some of the baseball fields.
What year would you think?
It was about 58 or 9, and then the park got developed further with my dad's interest in it and other contributions. They built the three-par golf course to the north of it, and then. Then they built tennis courts over on the east side. They had carved out 20 acres for Memorial High School on the east side. When they made the setup LaFortune Park, they put that aside for the school, which turned out to be a wonderful adjacency, you might say, for the school. Mm-hmm. And that's how the development of LaFortune Park occurred.
Great. Anything else you would want to contribute to this? Or is there any, is Lynn still here?
I am. I'm here.
Did you want to ask any questions?
We haven't talked about the Gilchrist Museum. That didn't really occur because of anything I did. It already occurred, but mm-hmm. that was the nucleus of the Tulsa Historical Society. You know, the original mm-hmm. headquarters for THS was the old Gilchrist home mm-hmm. Next to the museum. Mm-hmm. And there are probably some people you could interview that could tell you a lot more about sure. when Tom Gilchrist lived there.
Okay.
I have a couple of events I wanted to ask about.
Sure.
And it would have been during your years as mayor. I think there was a major flood maybe, and
yeah, flooding.
Tornado maybe in 74.
Yeah, flooding was a big, big issue.
Right.
While I was a street commissioner and mayor. And there's a little background to that is kind of hard to explain, but the fact is, when I first became a street commissioner, the city of Tulsa had a very restricted, very restrictive city limit. Our city limits were 51st Street on the south, probably Yale on the east, Arkansas River, maybe a little bit over towards Sand Springs, and as far north as probably 36th Street at the furthest, maybe even Apache. And they really didn't focus at all on drainage problems. So the philosophy then was, if these creeks out there in those outer areas flooded, so be it. And if you wanted to build a house on there, there wasn't any governmental restriction on what you wanted to do. And so when I came into office as a commissioner, we in particular we had already had some problems on Joe Creek in the south. And because a lot of new homes had been built along Mingo Creek, we began to see really big problems whenever we had minor flooding. And those homes would repeatedly get flooded out there. So at least because of as development occurred, the floods got worse because your runoff became heavier. So at least one of the things that I got started was the floodplain mapping program for the city. And we qualified the city through, because of the mapping program, we qualified the city for flood insurance for all of these people who lived in those flood-prone areas. The problem was you couldn't make the areas go away, and we lacked the money to do the channelization and all of the detention system that exists today. We just didn't have the funds. And even though we would put minor drainage projects in bond issues, it wasn't solving the big problem. And the big problem has been solved essentially since I left office by the construction of significant detention facilities and big channelization projects.
Didn't the city buy back some of the properties that were flooded?
A fairly minor way, but yes, they did.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to contribute to this? Or? A new revelation, a confession? Or?
Well, you wouldn't want me to tell you about all the mistakes I made.
Well, no, I don't want to hear it. Well, if not, I'm going to conclude this, and I do appreciate you coming to the okay. Historical Society and talking to us. This is great information, and I'm sure the society will have benefit of it. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.